She'd searched and failed to find the thing that was going to happen. She stood beside Edgar's mother or father and waited for them to call it out. But they'd forgotten about it, or more likely had never known in the first place. There were things like that, she'd learned, obvious things they didn't know. The way they ran their hands down her sides and scratched along her backbone consoled her, but the fact was she wanted a job to do. By then she'd been in the house for almost a year, away from her littermates, away from the sounds and smells of the kennel, with only the daily training work to occupy her. Now even that had become routine, and she wasn't the kind of dog who could be idle for long without growing unhappy. If they didn't know about this thing, it was all that much more important that she find it and show them. In April, she began to wake in the night and wander the house, pausing beside the vacant couch and the blowing furnace registers, to ask what they knew, but they never answered. Or knew, but couldn't say. Always at the end of those moonlight prowls, she found herself standing in the room with the crib, where, at odd moments, she might discover Trudy rearranging the chest of drawers or brushing her hand through the mobile suspended over it. From the doorway, her gaze was drawn to the rocking chair, bathed in the pale night light that filtered through the curtained window. She recalled a time when she'd slept beside that chair while Trudy rocked in the dark. She approached and dropped her nose below the seat and lifted it an inch, encouraging it to remember and tell her what more it knew, but it only tilted back and forth in silence. It was clear that the bed positively knew the secret, but it wasn't saying, no matter how many times she asked. Edgar's parents awoke one night to find her dragging away the blanket in a moment of spite. In the morning, she poked her nose at the truck, the traveler, as she thought of it, sitting petrified in the driveway. But it, too, kept all secrets close and made no reply. And so near the end of that time, she could only commiserate with Trudy, who now obviously longed to find the thing as much as Almandine, and who had, for some reason, begun to spend her time lying in bed instead of going to the kennel. The idea, it seemed, was to stop hunting for the thing entirely and let the house yield up its secret on its own. There came a morning when they woke while it was still dark outside, and Gar began to rush around the house, stopping only long enough to make two quick phone calls. He threw some things into a suitcase and carried it out to the truck, and then carried it back in again and threw some more things inside. And all the while he did this, Almandine watched Trudy dress slowly and deliberately. When she finished, she sat on the edge of the bed and said, "Relax, Gar. There's plenty of time." They walked down the steps together, and Almandine escorted the two of them to the truck. When Trudy was seated in the cab, Almandine circled back and waited for the tailgate to open. But instead, Gar led her to the kennel and opened the door to an empty run. She stood in the aisle and looked at him, incredulous. "Go on," he said. She considered the temptation of the open barn door. Morning light poured in from behind Gar, casting his shadow along the dry, dusty cement floor and over her. In the end, she let him take her collar and lead her into the pen, which was the best she could do. Then there was the sound of the truck starting and tires on gravel. Some of the dogs barked out of habit at the noise, but Almandine was too stunned to do anything but stand in the straw and wait for the truck to return and Gar to rush back inside to get her. When she finally lay down, it was so near the door that tufts of her fur pressed through the squares of wire. Dr. Papineau arrived that evening and dished out food and water and checked on the pups. The next morning, Edgar's father returned, but he hurried through the chores, leaving Almandine in the kennel run. That evening, it was Papineau again. When the night came on, she stood in the outer kennel run, listening to the spring peepers begin their cacophony and the bats flickering overhead. and she looked at the frozen oculus of the moon as it rose above the trees and cast its blue radiance across the field. It was just cool enough for her breath to light up, and for a long time she stood there, panting, trying to imagine what it was that was happening. Some of the other dogs pressed through the doors of their runs and stood with her. The old stone silo loomed over them. After a while, she gave up and pushed back inside and curled into a corner and set her gaze on the motionless barn doors. Another day passed, then two more. In the morning, Almandine heard the sound of the truck pulling into the yard, followed by a car. When Trudy's voice reached her, Almandine put her paws on the pen door and joined in the barking for the first time since she'd been out there. Gar came out to the barn and opened her pen. She whirled in the aisle, then bolted for the back porch steps and turned and panted over her shoulder, waiting for him to catch up. Trudy sat in her chair in the living room, a white blanket in her arms. Dr. Papineau was on the couch, hat on his lap. Almandine approached, quivering with curiosity. She slid her muzzle carefully along Trudy's shoulder, stopping just inches from the blanket, and she narrowed her eyes and inhaled a dozen short breaths. Faint huffing sounds emanated from the fabric, and a delicate pink hand jerked out. Five fingers splayed and relaxed, and so managed to express a yawn. That would have been the first time Almandine saw Edgar's hands. In a way, that would have been the first time she saw him make a sign. That miniature hand was so moist and pink and interesting, the temptation was almost irresistible. She pressed her nose forward another fraction of an inch. "No licks," Trudy whispered in her ear. Almandine began to wag her tail, slowly at first, then faster, as if something long held motionless inside her had gained momentum enough to break free. The swing of her tail rocked her chest and shoulders like a counterweight. She withdrew her muzzle from across Trudy's chest and licked at the air, and with that small joke she lost all reserve and she playbowed and woofed quietly. As a result, she was downstayed. But she didn't mind as long as she was in a place where she could watch. Dr. Papineau sat with them for an hour or so. Their talk sounded low and serious. Somehow, Almandine concluded that they were worried about the baby, that something wasn't right. And yet she could see that the baby was fine. He squirmed, he breathed, he slept. When Dr. Papineau excused himself, Edgar's father went to the barn to do the chores properly for the first time in 4 days, and his mother, exhausted, looked out the windows while the infant slept. It was mid-afternoon on a spring day, brilliant, green, and cool. The house hunched quietly around them all, and then, sitting upright in her chair, Edgar's mother fell asleep. Almandine lay on the floor and watched, puzzling over something. As soon as Gar had opened the kennel door, she'd been sure that the house was about to reveal its secret, that now she would find the thing that was going to happen. When she'd seen the blanket and scented the baby, she'd thought maybe that was it. But it seemed to her now that wasn't right either. Whatever the secret was, it had to do with the baby. But it wasn't simply the fact of the baby. While Almandine pondered this, a sound reached her ears. A whispery rasp, barely audible even to her. At first she couldn't make sense of it. The moment she'd walked into the room, she'd heard the breaths coming from the blanket, the ones that nearly matched his mother's breathing. And so it took her a moment to understand that in this new sound she was hearing distress. To realize that this near silence was the sound of him wailing. She waited for the sound to stop, but it went on and on, as quiet as the rustle of the new leaves on the apple trees. That was what the concern had been about, she realized. The baby had no voice. It couldn't make a sound. Almandine began to pant. She shifted her weight from one hip to the other, and as she looked on and saw his mother continue to sleep, she finally understood. The thing that was going to happen was that her time for training was over, and now, at last, she had a job to do. And so Amandine gathered her legs beneath her and broke her stay. She crossed the room and paused beside the chair, and she became in that moment, and was ever after, a cautious dog. For suddenly it seemed important that she be right in this. And looking at the two of them there, one silently bawling, one slumped in graceful exhaustion, certainty unfolded in her the way morning light fills a north room. She drew her tongue along his mother's face, just once, very deliberately, then stepped back. His mother startled awake. After a moment she shifted the blanket and its contents and adjusted her blouse, and soon enough the whispery sounds the baby had been making were replaced by other sounds Almandine recognized, equally quiet, but carrying no note of distress. Almandine walked back to where she had been stayed. All of this had happened in the space of a moment or two, and through the pads of her feet she could feel how her body had warmed a place on the rug. She stood for a long time, looking at the two of them. Then she lay down and tucked her nose under the tip of her tail, and she slept. Signs. What was there to do with such an infant child but worry over him? Gar and Trudy worried that he would never have a voice. His doctors worried that he didn't cough. And Almandine simply worried whenever the boy was out of her sight, though he never was for long. Quickly enough, they discovered that no one understood a case like Edgar's. Such children existed only in textbooks, and even those were different in a thousand particulars from this baby, whose lips worked when he wanted to nurse, whose hands paddled the air when his parents diapered him, who smelled faintly like fresh flour and tasted like the sea, who slept in their arms and woke and compared in puzzlement their faces with the ether of some distant world, silent in contentment and silent in distress. The doctors shone their lights into him and made their guesses, but who lived with him morning and evening? Who set their alarm to check him by moonlight? Who snuck in each morning to find a wide-eyed grub peering up from the crib, skin translucent as onion paper? The doctors made their guesses, but every day Trudy and Gar saw proof of normalcy and strangeness and drew their own conclusions. And all infants need the same simple things, pup or child, squalling or mute. They clung to that certainty. For a while, at least, it didn't matter what in him was special and what ordinary. He was alive. What mattered was that he opened his eyes every single morning. Compared to that, silence was nothing. By September, Trudy had had enough of waiting rooms and charts and tests, not to mention the expense and time away from the kennel. All summer she'd told herself to wait, that any day her baby would begin to cry and jabber like other children. Yet the question seemed increasingly dire. Some nights she could hardly sleep for wondering. And if medical science couldn't supply an answer, there might be other ways to know. One evening she told Gar they needed formula, and she bundled up Edgar and put him in the truck and drove to Popcorn Corners. The leaves on the trees were every shade of red and yellow, and crinkled brown discards covered the dirt of Town Line Road, swirling in the vortex of the pickup as it passed along. She parked in front of the rickety old grocery and sat looking at the neon open sign glowing orange in the front window. The interior of the place was brightly lit but vacant, save for a gray-haired old woman, crane-like, countenance ancient, sitting behind the counter. Ida Payne, the proprietor. Inside, a radio played quietly. A fiddle melody was just audible over the rustle of leaves in the night breeze. Trudy had brought the truck to a halt directly before the big plate glass window fronting the store, and Ida Payne had to know Trudy was out there. But the old woman sat like a fixture, her hands folded in her lap, a cigarette burning somewhere out of sight. If Trudy hadn't been afraid someone would come along, she might have waited a very long time in the truck. But she took a breath and tucked Edgar into her arms and walked into the store. Then she didn't know quite what to do. When she realized that the radio had stopped playing, she temporarily lost the ability to speak. Ida Payne looked at her from her perch. She wore oversized glasses that magnified her eyes, and behind the lenses those eyes blinked and blinked again. Trudy looked at Edgar, cradled in her arms, and decided that coming in had been a bad idea. She was turning to leave when Ida Payne broke the silence. "Let me see," she said. Ida didn't hold out her hands or come around the counter, nor was there a grandmotherly note in her voice. If anything, her tone was incurious and weary, though benign. Trudy stepped forward and laid Edgar on the counter between them, where the wooden surface was worn velvety from an eternity's caress of tin cans and pickle jars. When she let go, Edgar bicycled his legs and grasped the air as if it were made of some elastic matter none of them could feel. Ida leaned forward and examined him with dilated eyes. Two gray streams of cigarette smoke whistled from her nostrils. Then she lifted one blue-veined hand and extended a pinky that reminded Trudy of nothing so much as the plucked wingtip of a chicken, and she poked the flesh of Edgar's thigh. His eyes widened, tears welled in them. From his mouth came the faintest huff. Trudy had watched a dozen doctors prod her son, feeling hardly a tremor, but this she couldn't bear. She reached forward, meaning to reclaim her baby. "Wait," Ida said. She bent lower and tipped her head and pressed that avian pinky into the infant's palm. His tiny fingers spasmed, closed around it. Ida Payne stood like that for what seemed hours. Trudy stopped breathing entirely. Then she let out a gasp and scooped Edgar into her arms and stepped back from the counter. Outside, at the four-way stop, a pair of headlights appeared. Neither Trudy nor Ida moved. The neon open sign darkened, and an instant later, the ceiling fluorescence winked out. In the dark, Trudy could make out Ida's crone silhouette, and her hand raised before her, considering her pinky. The headlights resolved into a station wagon, and the station wagon rolled into the dirt parking lot and paused and accelerated back onto the blacktop. "No," Ida Payne grunted with some finality.
"Not ever?"
"He can use his hands." By then, the whine of car tires had faded into the night. Orange worms of plasma began to flux and crawl in the tubes of the open sign. Overhead, the ballasts hummed, and the fluorescence flickered and lit. Trudy waited for some elaboration from Ida, but understood soon enough that she stood in the presence of a terse oracle indeed.
"That it?"
was all the more Ida Payne had to say.
"Anything else?"
A month later, a woman came to visit. Trudy was in the kitchen fixing a late lunch while Gar tended a newly whelped litter in the kennel. When the knock came, Trudy walked to the porch where a stout woman waited, dressed in a flowered skirt and a white blouse, her steel-gray hair done up in a tightly wound permanent. She gripped her handbag and looked over her shoulder at the kennel dogs, raising the alarm. "Hello," the woman said with an uncertain smile. "I'm afraid you're going to think this very inappropriate. Your dogs certainly do." She smoothed down the front of her skirt. "My name is Louisa Wilkes," she continued, "and I... well, the fact is, I don't exactly know why I'm here." Trudy asked her to come inside if she didn't mind Almondine. She didn't mind dogs at all, Louisa Wilkes said, not in ones and twos. Mrs. Wilkes settled on the couch, and Amandine curled up in front of the bassinet where Edgar slept. Something about the prim way she walked and folded her hands when she sat made Trudy think she was a Southerner, though she had no accent Trudy could detect. "What can I do for you?" Trudy said. "Well, as I said, I'm not sure. I'm here visiting my nephew and his wife, John and Eleanor Wilkes." "Oh, yes, of course," Trudy said. She had thought the name Wilkes sounded familiar, but hadn't been able to place it. "We see Eleanor in town once in a while. She and John look after one of our dogs." "Yes, that was the very first thing I noticed, your dogs. There, Ben is a wonderful animal. Very bright eyes," she said, looking at Almandine. "Like this one. Same way of peering at you, too. In any case, I talked them into lending me their car for the morning so I could see the countryside. I know it's odd, but I like the quiet of a car when I'm alone in it. A ways back, I found myself at a little store, practically in the middle of nowhere. I'd hoped they sold sandwiches, but they didn't. I bought some crackers instead, and a soda. The store is run by the strangest woman." "You must be talking about Popcorn Corners," Trudy said. "That's Ida Payne's store. Ida can be a little spooky." "So I discovered. After I paid the woman, she told me I wanted to follow the highway a bit farther and take this side road and look for the dogs. It was strange. I hadn't asked for directions. And that's the way she put it, too. Not that I should or could, but that I wanted to. She said it through the window screen as I was walking to my car. I asked her what she meant, but she just sat there. I intended to turn back the way I came, but then I was curious. I found the road just where she said it would be. When I saw your dogs, I..." She broke off. "Well, that's all there is to tell. I parked on the road, and now here I am, feeling loony for having walked in." Louisa Wilkes looked around the living room, fidgeting with her purse. "But I do have the feeling we should talk some more. You're a new mother," she said. She walked to the bassinet, and Trudy joined her. "His name is Edgar." The baby was wide awake. He scrunched his eyebrows at the unhappy sight of a woman, not his mother, leaning over him, and he stretched his mouth wide, making silence. The woman frowned and looked at Trudy. "Yes, he doesn't use his voice. The equipment is all there, but when he cries, there's no sound. We don't know why." At this, Louisa Wilkes stood up straight. "And how old is he?" "Just shy of 6 months." "Is there a chance he's deaf? It's very simple to test for, even in infants. You just clap your hands and see if they flinch, yes. We've known from the start that his hearing is fine. When he's in his bassinet and I start to talk, he looks around." "Why do you ask? Do you know another case like his?" "I'm sure I don't, Mrs. Sautel. I've never heard of anything like it. What I do know about... Well, first of all, I'm not a nurse, much less a doctor." "I'm glad to hear that. I'm out of patience with doctors. All they've told us is what isn't wrong with Edgar, and that amounts to everything besides his voice. They've tested how fast his pupils dilate. They've tested his saliva. They've drawn blood. They've even taken EKGs. It's amazing what they can rule out on a newborn. But I finally had to draw the line. I won't have my baby tormented all through his infancy. And all you have to do is spend a few minutes with him to know he's a perfectly normal baby." Almandine was up now, scenting the bassinet and their visitor with equal concern. Mrs. Wilkes looked down at her. "Benny is such an extraordinary animal," she said. "I've never seen a dog quite so aware of conversation. I could swear he turns toward me when he thinks it's my turn to speak." "Yes," Trudy said. "They understand more than we give them credit for." "Oh, it's more than that. I've been around plenty of dogs. Dogs that lie on your lap and fall asleep. Dogs that bark at every stranger who walks past. Dogs that crouch on the floor and watch you like a long-lost beau. But I've never seen a dog behave that way." Louisa Wilkes looked at Edgar in the bassinet. Then she turned and lifted her hands and moved them through the air, looking intently at Trudy. Her motions were fluid and expressive and entirely silent. She paused long enough to be sure that Trudy realized what she had seen, even if she hadn't understood its meaning. "What I just said is, I am the child of two profoundly deaf parents." Another swift flight of hands. "I'm not deaf myself, but I teach sign at a school for the deaf. And I'm wondering, Mrs. Sawtelle, what will happen if it turns out that your boy lacks the power of speech, but nothing else?" Trudy noticed how deftly Louisa Wilkes phrased her questions. A steeliness that emerged the moment she signed. Something almost fierce. Trudy liked that. Louisa Wilkes wasn't beating around the bush. And Trudy could hardly have forgotten Ida Payne's pronouncement that autumn night, "He can use his hands." At the time, Trudy thought Ida Payne had meant that Edgar would only be able to use his hands, that he was destined for menial work, which Trudy knew was wrong. The whole episode had made her angry, and she'd chalked it up to foolishness, her own. She never mentioned the incident to Gar. Now Trudy began to suspect she'd misunderstood Ida Payne. "He'll make do, Mrs. Wilkes. I think we found out that there's nothing else different about Edgar. Perhaps, as he grows, his voice will come. Since we don't know why it's gone in the first place, there's no way to tell if this is temporary." "He's never uttered a sound? Not even once?" "No, never." "And the doctors? What did they tell you to do while you're waiting to find out if your son might or might not find a voice?" "That's been so discouraging. They've told me only the most obvious things, to talk to him, which I do, so if he has a choice, he'll imitate his mother." "Did they suggest any exercises? Anything you might do with him?" "None, really. They speculated on what we might do in a few years if nothing changes, but for now, just watch him. If, when something changes, we go from there." Hearing this, Mrs. Wilkes' reserve, rapidly diminishing ever since the topic had turned to deafness, dropped away entirely. "Mrs. Sawtelle, listen to me now. I don't mean to presume anything, and for all I know, what I'm about to tell you, you've already read or been told. Though from the sound of it, the doctors you've seen have been woefully ignorant, which wouldn't surprise me at all. You cannot begin too early to bring the power of language to children whose grasp may be precarious. No one can say for sure when children begin to learn language. That is, we don't know how early in their lives they understand that they can talk and should talk, that through speech they will lead fulfilling lives. There is, on the other hand, evidence that by the age of one, the gift of language begins slipping away unless it's nurtured. This has happened to deaf children throughout history, and it's quite a terrible thing. Children considered retarded and left to fend for themselves. I'm talking about perfectly intelligent, capable children, abandoned because they didn't know that sound existed. How could they? By the time someone recognized that they lacked only hearing, they were handicapped forever. But everything you say applies to children who can't hear, not to children who can't make sound. And there's no doubt that Edgar can hear. But what about speech? A person communicates by giving as well as taking, by expressing what is inside. Infants learn this by crying. They learn that drawing attention to themselves in even the most primitive way gains them warmth and food and comfort. I worry about your child, Mrs. Sawtelle. I wonder how he'll learn these things. Let me tell you about myself for a moment. When I was born, my own parents were faced with a dilemma. How could they teach me to speak? They hadn't learned until it was far too late in their teens, and so they mastered everything but the production of intelligible speech. And now they had a daughter who they wanted more than anything in the world to speak normally. What did they do? They assumed that I was learning even when I seemed to be doing nothing. They played records with conversations, though they couldn't hear anything themselves. They bought a radio and asked their hearing friends to tell them which stations to tune in and when. They watched my mouth to see if I was making sounds. They arranged for me to spend time with people who could play with me and speak to me. In short, Mrs. Sawtelle, they made sure that verbal language was available to me in every way they could imagine. But there must have been more to it than that. How do they respond when you spoke your first words? How do they encourage you when they couldn't hear you speak? Mrs. Wilkes talked then about the readiness of babies to learn language, how impossible it was to prevent, so long as examples were available, how isolated twins sometimes invented private languages. She went on for quite some time. She had worked with both deaf children and the hearing children of deaf parents, she said, and there was a simple principle. The baby wanted to communicate. It would learn whatever was given as an example, whether English, French, German, Chinese, or sign. As a child, she had learned to sign as well as speak, almost effortlessly. This last point, she said, was most significant for the Sawtell baby. "But how can I teach him to sign?" Trudy said. "I don't know how myself." "Then you will learn together," Mrs. Wilkes said. "At first, you only need to know enough to talk with Edgar in the simplest ways." "Which are?" "Which are to tell him you love him. To say, here is food. To name things. Dog, bird, daddy, mama, sky, cloud. Just like any child. Show him how to ask for things he wants by moving his hands in that sign. Show him how to ask for more of whatever he wants." And here she bounced the fingertips of both hands together as she talked to demonstrate. "And later, when the time comes to make sentences, you'll already have learned how to do that." Their conversation went on late into the evening. When Gar came in from the kennel, Mrs. Wilkes began demonstrating the basics. She said she could explain a few signs and straightforward syntax in an evening. And she began with simple words and simple sentences. She showed them a subject-verb-object sentence. Trudy loves Gar. She explained the miraculous way in which pronouns are used. She demonstrated an adjective. Trudy was mesmerized, repeating the signs and following Mrs. Wilkes' corrections studiously. Gar tried as well, though he lacked Trudy's coordination and grace. It was near midnight before the woman left, far past the time when they usually went to sleep. Edgar had roused several times during the evening, and when they took him up, Mrs. Wilkes demonstrated how to say food and move Edgar's hands. This was harder, since it required performing the sign backward. But it was possible, and Trudy understood the enormous leverage that practice gives the determined trainer. Edgar. This will be his earliest memory. Red light, morning light, high ceiling canted overhead, lazy click of toenails on wood. Between the honey-colored slats of the crib, a whiskery muzzle slides forward until its cheeks pull back and a row of dainty front teeth bare themselves in a ridiculous grin. The nose quivers, the velvet snout dimples. All the house is quiet. Be still. Stay still. Fine dark muzzle fur, black nose, leather of lacework creases, comma of nostrils flexing with each breath. A breeze shushes up the field and pillows the curtains inward. The apple tree near the kitchen window caresses the house with a tick-tickety-tick. As slowly as he can, he exhales, feigning sleep. But despite himself, his breath hitches. At once the muzzle knows he's awake. It snorts, angles right and left, withdraws. Outside the crib, Almondine's forequarters appear. Her head is reared back, her ears cocked forward. A cherry-brindled eye peers back at him. Whoosh of her tail. Be still. Stay still. The muzzle comes hunting again, tunnels beneath his blanket. Below the farmers and pigs and chicks and cows died into that cotton world. His hand rises on fingers and spider-walks across the surprised farmyard residents to challenge the intruder. It becomes a bird hovering before their eyes. Thumb and index fingers squeeze the crinkled black nose. The pink of her tongue darts out, but the bird flies away before Almondine can lick it. Her tail is switching harder now. Her body sways, her breath envelops him. He tugs the blackest whisker on her chin, and this time her tongue catches the palm of his hand ever so slightly. He pitches to his side, rubs his hand across the blanket, blows a breath in her face. Her ears flick back. She stomps a foot. He blows again, and she withdraws and bows and woofs low in her chest, quiet and deep, the boom of an uncontainable heartbeat. Hearing it, he forgets and presses his face against the rails to see her, all of her, take her inside him with his eyes. And before he can move, she smears her tongue across his nose and forehead. He claps a hand to his face, but it's too late. She's away, spinning, biting her tail, dancing in the moted sunlight that spills through the window glass. Bouncing on his mother's hip as she walks down the aisle of the kennel. Dogs rush through the canvas flaps in the barn wall, look at him, take his scent. Her voice sing-song as she calls to them. His father, sitting at the kitchen table, papers strewn before them, pictures of dogs. His father's voice quiet in his ear, talking through a lion cross. The corner of a pedigree pinched between his fingers. Running through the yard, past the milk house, throwing the fence gate closed before Almandine can catch him. He crouches in the tall weeds and watches. She loves to jump. Her stride draws up and she sails over the fence. In a moment she's next to him, panting. He clenches his fist and mock scowls. When she looks away, he bolts again. The weeds rush together behind him, and then he's in the orchard, monkey-crawling along a branch, the one place she cannot follow, dangling a hand to taunt her. All at once the world spins. When he hits the ground, a thump sounds in his chest. He begins to cry, but the only sound is Almandine's barking, and, after a moment, the kennel dogs. On the farthest apple tree hangs a tire, its rope hairy and moth-brown. He's been told to stay away, but forgotten why. He worms his shoulders through both circles of the rubber rim, twists, pumps his legs. The apple trees tilt crazily around him. It takes a minute for the bees to condense from shadow and sunlight, and then he's trapped in the careening tire, and they sting him, once on his neck, once on his arm. Hot points of light. Almandine snaps at the air, yelps, brushes a paw across her face. Then they're running to the house. The porch door slams behind. They wait to see if the bees will keep coming, grow thick against the screen. For a moment, Edgar almost believes the bees never existed. Then the stings begin to throb. Wandering through the kennel, holding a book, Winnie the Pooh. He opens a whelping pen, sits. The puppies surge through the underbrush of loose straw, kicking up fine white dust as they come along. He captures them between his legs and reads to them, hands in motion before their upturned muzzles. The mother comes over, and they peep like chicks when they see her. One by one, she carries them back to the whelping box. They hang black and bean-shaped from her mouth. When she's finished, she stands over them, looking at Edgar in reproach. "They wanted to hear," he signs at her, but the mother won't settle with her pups until he leaves. Winnie the Pooh is a good story for puppies. If only she would let him tell it. His father reading to him at bedtime, voice quiet, lamplight yellow on the lenses of his glasses. The story is The Jungle Book. Edgar wants to fall asleep with Mowgli and Bagheera still in his mind, for the story to cross from the lamplight into his dreams. His father's voice stops. He sits up. "More," he signs, fingertips together. His father starts the next page. He lies back and moves his hands through the air to the sound of his father's voice, thinking about words, the shapes of words. He's sitting on the gray, leatherette cushion of the doctor's bench and holding his mouth wide open. The doctor's face is close, looking into him. Then the doctor puts alphabet tiles on a table. The doctor asks him to spell apple, but there is only one P, and he can't do it right. The doctor turns to a notepad and writes something down while he tries to turn the B upside down so it will be right.
I'd like him to stay for a few days, the doctor says.
His mother shakes her head and frowns. The doctor presses a buzzing, flashlight-shaped thing against his throat.
Breathe out, he says. Pull your lips back. Touch your tongue to the roof of your mouth. Make a circle with your lips.
Edgar follows his instructions, and a word floats out of his mouth.
Yule.
But the sound is hideous, flies against a pane of glass.
Don't do that.
The doctor doesn't understand at first. Edgar uses the letterboard and goes slow for him. On the way home, they drink black cows at the Dog and Suds. On his mother's face, an expression, sorrow, anger. Sitting in the whelping pen, watching a new litter of puppies squirm. At 5 days old, they're too young to name, but this has become his job. One of the puppies is trying to climb over the others, pushing them aside to nurse. He's a bully. His name will be Hector, Edgar decides. Choosing names is hard. At night, he discusses it with his mother and father. He's very young, and has only now begun using his dictionary to find names and note them in the margins. The doctor brings in someone new, a man with a beard and black hair that falls to his shoulders. The man signs hello to him, a flick of his hand off his forehead, then asks him something, signing faster than Edgar has ever seen, one sign melting into another. Too fast, he signs. He grabs the man's wrists and makes him do it again. The man turns to the doctor, speaks a few words, and the doctor nods.
You sound funny,
Edgar signs. The man laughs, and even that is odd.
Do I?
He signs. I'm deaf. I've never heard my voice. Edgar stares at him, as if he didn't know a deaf person would look just the same. From behind the man, his mother frowns and shakes her head.
How old are you?
The man signs.
Almost 4, he says.
He holds up 4 fingers with his thumb tucked in, bumps the eye hand twice against his heart.
You're very good. I couldn't sign like you when I was 4.
I'm backward from you. I can hear okay.
Yes, it's good we both sign.
Can you sign with your dogs? Mine don't always understand.
My dog never understands, the man signs, smiling.
Almandine understands when I say this,
and Edgar signs something that only he and Almandine know. They watch Almandine approach. The man pauses and looks at the doctor. Standing in the aisle of the barn, his father sits in one of the pens with a mother, stroking her ears. The mother is so old, even her tail shows gray. She lies on her side, panting. His father points to the ceiling beams running crossways to the main aisle and tells him they came from trees Schultz felled in the woods behind the barn.
The first spring leaves sprouted from those beams, he says.
And Edgar sees for the first time the knots and scrapes, sees the tree hidden in each beam, and sees as well Schultz and his ponies heaving them up through the field. A string of bare light bulbs runs the length of the aisle, one descending from every other beam.
Hang on, gorgeous, his father says, turning back to the mother.
When Dr. Papineau arrives, Edgar leads him into the barn.
Over here, Pidge, Edgar's father says.
Dr. Papineau enters the pen and kneels. He runs his hands over the mother's belly and presses the coined tip of a stethoscope to her chest. Then he walks to his car and fetches a satchel. Edgar's father turns to him.
Go up to the house now, he says.
From the satchel, Dr. Papineau lifts a bottle and a syringe. Two rolling hills span the south field, one near their yard, one farther out. There's a rock pile in the middle, and a small grove of birches and a cross. Waves of hay lie over in the August breeze. Edgar plunges through the field, trying to lose Almandine. Always their game. He cuts around the rocks, dives under a birch, and lies as quietly as he can. He peers at the white cross, standing alone between him and the yard, and he wonders again what it means. It's so simple, straight and square, and sometime not too long before it has taken on a fresh, brilliant white coat of paint. Then the stalks of hay part, and Almandine trots up, panting. She flops down and presses a paw to his chest, as if to say, "Don't do that again. It's too hot for these games." But he jumps up and races away, and she's there beside him, mouth open and a smile. So often she runs ahead. So often he finds her waiting when he arrives. A late spring afternoon. Edgar and his mother sit on the living room couch. The television shows gray static, and the speakers hiss. All the shades are raised. Clouds like bruises scud over the fields. Outside, a sizzle flash. There's a snap from the kitchen as sparks fly from the electric sockets. He counts one, two, three, until the thunder rolls back at them from the hills. "It's the iron in the ground. It draws the lightning," his father has said. "See how red the dirt is? This is where the iron range begins." The pines flap their branches in the gusts, swimmers in the wind. He walks to the window to see if the treetops actually pierce the clouds. A tatter of white steam passes over the thrashing treetops, sliding counter to the motion of the storm. "Come away from the window," his mother says. Splats of rain hit the glass. Outside, an instant of brilliant light, and sparks leap from the kitchen outlets again. Thunder never arrives, and the extended silence is eerie. Was that cold lightning? Probably. There's hot lightning and cold lightning, she has told him. Only hot lightning makes thunder. The difference is important. A person hit by hot lightning is fried on the spot. A person struck by cold lightning walks away without a mark. His mother sits on the chair and watches the clouds. "I wish your father would come in here." "I'll get him." "No, you won't. You'll stay right here with me." She gives him a look that means no kidding around. "I'm taller than you now," he signs, trying to make her relax. Lately, he's begun to tease her about being the shortest in the family. She gives him a tight-lipped smile and turns back to the television. He doesn't quite know what they should be looking for, just that it will be obvious. From a Reader's Digest article, she's learned about the Weller method, which they are now performing. The television is tuned to channel 2 and dimmed until the static is nearly black. "We just keep watching," she'd explained. "If a tornado comes near, the screen turns white from the electrical field." They divide their attention between the jitter on the tube and the advancing shelf of cloud. His mother has an endless store of meteorological anecdotes. Ball lightning, tornadoes, hurricanes. But today, as during all the worst storms, a haunted look occupies her face. And he knows those stories roil inside her like the clouds in the sky. The television fizzles and crackles. Still, she's okay until Almandine comes over and leans against her for reassurance. "That's it," she says. "Down we go." The basement stairs are on the back porch. Through the screen door, they see his father standing in the doorway of the barn, his hair tousled by the wind. He's leaning against the jamb almost casually, his face turned skyward. "Gar," his mother shouts, "come in. We're going to the basement." "I'll stay here," he calls back. The wind makes his voice tinny and small. "It's going to be a wild one. You go on." She shakes her head and ushers them down the stairs. "Shoo, shoo," she says. "Let's go." Almandine plunges down the steps before them. There's a latch door at the bottom, and she waits with nose pressed to the crack, sniffing. Once inside, they squint at the clouds through the dusty basement transom windows. No rain is falling, only drips and blobs of water blown sideways through the air. "What does he think he'll accomplish out there?" she says, fuming. "All he wants to do is watch the storm." "You're right. He just stands in the doorway like that. The dogs can take care of themselves. It's having him out there that stirs them up, as if he could protect the barn. It's ridiculous." Lightning plunges into the field nearby. Thunder shakes the house. "Oh, God," his mother says. This last strike has started Edgar's heart smashing, too. He dashes up the cement stairs for a look. As he reaches the top, there's a blue-white flash, dazzlingly bright, and a bomb sound. Then he's flying down the stairs again. But not before he's seen for himself. His father still standing with one hand on the barn door, braced as if daring the storm to touch him. And it's clear then that everything so far has been a prelude. The wind blows not in fits and gusts, but with a sustained howl that makes Edgar wonder when the windows will shatter from the pressure. Almandine whines, and he draws his hand along her back and croup. A timber groans from inside the walls. His mother has herded them to the southwest corner of the basement. Anecdotally, the safest if a tornado lifts the house off its foundation, Wizard of Oz style. The wind blows for a long time, so long it becomes laughable. And strangely, with the gale at full force, sunlight begins to stream through the transom windows. That's the first sign the storm will pass. Only later does the solid roar of air slacken in descending octaves until all that remains is an ironic summer breeze. "Sit tight," his mother says. Edgar can see her thinking, "Eye of the storm." But his father's voice echoes across the yard. "That was a doozy." Outside, it's impossible not to look first at the sky, where a field of summer cumulus, innocuous and white, stretches westward. The storm clouds glower above the treetops across the road. The house and barn seem untouched. The pine trees stand quiet and whole, the apple trees intact at first glance, until he notices that every blossom has been stripped bare, every petal swept away by the wind. Hardly a drop of rain has fallen, and the air is dusty and choking. Edgar and Almandine circulate through the house, plugging in the stove, the toaster, the dryer, the air conditioner, and the living room window. The mailman pauses his car beside the mailbox and drives off with a wave. Edgar jogs up the driveway to fetch the contents, a single letter, hand-addressed to his father. The postmark says, Portsmouth, Virginia. He's reaching for the handle on the porch door when his father's shout rises from behind the barn. The four of them stand in the weeds behind the barn, gazing upward. A ragged patch of shingles the size of the living room floor hangs from the eaves like a flap of crusty skin thick with nails. A third of the roof lies exposed, gray and bare. Before their eyes, the barn has become the weathered hull of a ship upturned. But what astonishes them, what makes them stand with jaws agape, is this. Near the peak, a dozen roofing boards have detached from the rafters and curled back in long, crazy-looking hoops that stop just short of making a circle. The most spectacular corkscrew up and away, as if a giant hand had reached down and rolled them between its fingers. Where the boards have peeled back, the ribs of the barn show through, roughly joined and mortised by Schultz so long ago. The breeze rattles the roofing boards like bones. A thin alphabet of yellow straw dust escapes from the mow and flies over the barn's long spine. After a while, Edgar remembers the letter, lifts it absently, holds it out to his father. Every nook and cranny,
Early morning, a week after the storm had inflicted its peculiar damage on the barn roof. Edgar and Almandine stood atop the bedroom stairs, boy and dog surveying 12 descending treads, their surfaces crested by smooth sanded knots and shot with cracks wide enough to stand a nickel in, and varnished so thickly by Schultz that all but the well-worn centers shone with a maroon gloss. Treacherous for people in stocking feet, and unnerving to the four-legged. What most impressed Edgar was not their appearance, but their gift for vocalization. Everything from groans to nail squeals, and many novelties besides, depending on the day of the week, or the humidity, or what book you happen to be carrying. The challenge that morning was to descend in silence, not just Edgar, but Edgar and Almandine together. He knew the pattern of quiet spots by heart. Far right on the 12th and 11th step, 10th and 9th safe anywhere, the 8th good on the left, the 6th and 5th quiet in the middle. A tricky switch from the far right of the 4th to the left of middle on the 3rd, and so on. But the 7th step had never let them by without a grunt or a rifle shot crack. He'd lost interest in the riddle of it for a long time, but the sight of the barn's demented roofing planks had reminded him that wood in all shapes could be mysterious, and he'd resolved to try again. He negotiated the first 4 steps and turned. Here he signed, pointing to a place on the tread for Almandine. Here, here. Each time she placed a broad padded foot where his fingers touched the tread. And silence ensued. Then he stood on the 8th step, the brink, with Almandine nosing his back and waiting. He swung his foot over the 7th tread like a dowser looking for water. Toward the right side, he knew, the thing creaked. In the middle, it let out a sound like a rust-seized door hinge. His foot hovered and drifted over the wood. Finally, it came to a stop above an owl-eyed swirl of grain near the wall on the left. He carefully settled his weight onto the tread. Silence. He stepped quickly down to the 6th and 5th and turned back, and picked up Almandine's foot and stroked it. He tapped the owl eye. Here. She stepped down. Yes, good girl. In time, they stood at the base of the stairs together, having arrived without a sound. A quiet moment of exultation passed between them as they headed for the kitchen. He didn't intend to tell anyone he'd found the way down. They were a small family living in a small farmhouse, with no neighbors and hardly any time or space to themselves. If he managed to share one secret with his father and a different one with his mother and yet another with Almandine, the world felt that much larger. They didn't say where his father was going, only that it was a long day's drive before he would return with Claude. It was late May and school was in session, though barely, and when he asked to go along, he knew the answer would be no. That morning, he and Almandine and his mother watched the truck top the hill on Town Line Road, and then they walked to the barn for morning chores. A pile of second-hand LPs and an old suitcase-style record player occupied a lower shelf of the workshop. 2 pennies had been taped to the needle arm, covering the lightning bolt Z in the zenith, embossed in the fluted metal. Through the speaker grill, a person could make out the filaments glowing igneous orange in their silver-nippled tubes. His mother unsleeved one of her favorite records and set it on the turntable. Edgar cleaned the kettle to the sound of Patsy Cline's voice. When he finished, he found his mother in the whelping room. She was holding a pup in the air in front of her, examining it and singing under her breath how she was crazy for trying, crazy for crying, crazy for loving it. The truck was still gone when he got off the school bus that afternoon. His mother enlisted his help retrieving sheets from the clothesline. "Don't they smell great?" she said, holding the fabric to her face. "It's so nice to hang them out again."
They tramped up the stairs to the spare room, located across the hallway from Edgar's bedroom. That morning it had been brimming with stacks of Dog World and Field and Stream, and a menagerie of cast-off furniture and broken appliances and many other familiars. A rollaway bed with a pinstriped mattress, closed up clam-style. A set of seat-split kitchen chairs. Two brass floor lamps teetering like long-legged birds. And most of all, innumerable cross-flapped cardboard boxes, which he'd spent long afternoons digging through, hoping to unearth an old photo album. They had photographs of every dog that ever raised, but none of themselves. Perhaps, he'd thought, one of those boxes held some faded image that would reveal how his mother and father had met. His mother swung the door open with a flourish. "What do you think?" she asked. "I'll give you a hint. Personally, I can't believe the difference." She was right. The room was transformed. The boxes were gone. The window glass sparkled. The wooden floor had been swept and mopped, and the foldaway bed had been laid out flat, and at its head a little table he had never seen before acted as a nightstand. A warm breeze sucked the freshly laundered curtains against the screen and blew them out again, and somehow the whole room smelled like a lemon orchard. "Great," he sighed. "It's never looked this good." "Of course not. It's been filled with junk. You know what the best part is? Your father says that this used to be Claude's room when he was growing up. Can you imagine that? Here, you get that side." She billowed a sheet over the mattress, and they tucked their way up from the foot of the bed. Each of them stuffed a pillow into a pillowcase. His mother kept looking at him as they worked. Finally, she stopped and stood up. "What's bothering you?" "Nothing. I don't know." He paused and looked around. "What did you do with everything?" "I found some nooks and crannies. A lot of it I put in the basement. I thought you and your father could cart those old chairs to the dump this weekend." Then she slipped into sign, which she performed unhurriedly and with great precision. "Did you want to ask me something about Claude? Have I ever met him when I was little?" "No, I've only met him once myself. He enlisted in the Navy the year before I met your father, and he's only been back once for your grandfather's funeral." "Why did he join the Navy?" "I don't know. Sometimes people enlist to see more of the world. Your father says Claude didn't always get along with your grandfather. That's another reason people enlist. Or maybe none of those things." "How long is he staying?" "A while, until he finds a place of his own. He's been gone a long time. He might not stay at all. This might be too small of a place for him now." "Does he know about the dogs?" She laughed. "He grew up here. He probably doesn't know them like your father does. Not anymore. He sold his share of the kennel to your father when your grandfather died." Edgar nodded. After they were finished, he waited until his mother was occupied, and then carried the lamps up from the basement to his room. He set them on opposite sides of his bookshelves, and he and Almandine spent the afternoon pulling books off the shelves and leafing through them. It was long after dark when the headlights of the truck swept the living room walls. Edgar and his mother and Almandine waited on the back porch while his father turned the truck around by the barn. The porch light glinted off the glass of the windshield, and the truck rolled to a stop. His father got out of the cab, his expression serious, even cross, though it softened when he looked up at them. He gave a small, silent wave, then walked to the rear of the truck and opened the topper and lifted out a lone suitcase. At first, Claude stayed inside the cab, visible only in silhouette. He craned his neck to look around. Then the passenger door swung open, and he stepped out, and Edgar's father walked up beside him. It was impossible not to make comparisons. His father's brother wore an ill-fitting serge suit, in which he looked uneasy and shabbily formal. From the way it hung on him, he was the thinner of the two. Claude's hair was black, where his father's was peppered. He stood with a slightly stooped posture, perhaps from the long drive, which made it hard to tell who was taller. And Claude didn't wear glasses. In all, Edgar's first impression was of someone quite different from his father. But then Claude turned to look at the barn, and in profile the similarities jumped out, the shapes of their noses and chins and foreheads. And when they walked into the side yard, their gaits were identical, as if their bodies were hinged in precisely the same way. Edgar had a sudden strange thought. That's what it's like to have a brother.
"Looks about the same," Claude was saying. His voice was deeper than Edgar's father's, and gravelly. "I guess I expected things to have changed some."
"There's more difference than you think," his father said. Edgar could hear the irritation in his tone from across the yard.
"We repainted a couple of years back, but we stayed with white. The sashes on the two front windows rotted out, so we replaced them with that big picture window. You'll see when we get inside. And a lot of the wiring and plumbing has been fixed. Stuff you can't see."
"That's new,"
Claude said, nodding at the pale green LP gas cylinder beside the house.
"We got rid of the coal furnace almost 10 years ago," his father said.
He put his hand lightly on Claude's back, and his voice sounded friendly again. "Come on, let's go in. We can look around later." He steered Claude toward the porch. When they reached the steps, Claude went up first. Edgar's mother held the door, and Claude stepped through and turned.
"Hello, Trudy," he said.
"Hello, Claude," she said. "Welcome home. It's nice to have you here."
She hugged him briefly, squeezing up her shoulders in an embrace that was both friendly and slightly formal. Then she stepped back, and Edgar felt her hand on his shoulder.
"Claude, meet Edgar," she said.
Claude shifted his gaze from Trudy and held out his hand. Edgar shook it, though awkwardly. He was surprised at how hard Claude squeezed, how it made him aware of the bones in his hands, and how calloused Claude's palms were. Edgar felt like he was gripping a hand made of wood. Claude looked him up and down.
"Pretty good size, aren't you?"
It wasn't exactly what Edgar expected him to say. Before he could reply, Claude's gaze shifted again, this time to Almandine, who stood swinging her tail in anticipation.
"And this is?"
"Almandine."
Claude knelt, and it was clear at once that he had been around dogs a long time. Instead of petting Almandine or scratching her ruff, he held out his hand, knuckle first, for her to sniff. Then he puckered his lips and whistled a quietly hummed tweedle, high and low at the same time. Almandine sat up straight and cocked her head left and right. Then she stepped forward and scented Claude thoroughly. When Edgar looked up, his father had a look of shocked recollection on his face.
"Hey, girl," Claude said. "What a beauty."
Only after Almandine had finished taking his scent did Claude touch her. He stroked her withers and scratched her on the chest behind her elbow and ran his hand along her belly. She closed up her mouth and arched her back in a gesture of tolerant satisfaction.
"Man, it's been..."
Claude seemed at a loss for words.